is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us today. World AIDS Day, observed annually on December the 1st since 1988, honors those that have been lost to HIV/AIDS while providing support to those living with the virus. This year's theme, titled Collective Action, Sustain and Accelerate HIV Progress, emphasizes the need for continued global collaboration in the fight against the deadly disease. Ugandan activist Brian Ahimbisibwe tells me that despite the substantial progress made in fighting the epidemic, more work needs to be done to counter the stigma, gender inequality, and other barriers to healthcare. He says that this can be done through education, prevention, and the widespread provision of antiretroviral therapy. He joins me in studio. Let's talk about your story and then talk about your work. You know, how did you start on this journey of activism?
Yeah, thank you, Jackson. So this journey of activism began when I was 13, I think. So I grew up taking medication. I mean, that's the only life I know. So I imagined everyone around me took medication until one day when my friend walked to me and asked if the medication was for HIV.
You didn't know why you were taking the medication?
No, I had no idea.
I am assuming you did not start taking the medication at 13. That's just you were aware of it at 13.
Yes, like I said from the introduction, it's the only life I know. So as a young boy, I thought everyone takes medication. And this is something that reflects back as an adult when I'm trying to talk to young people who feel like antiretroviral therapy is a burden. And I tell them, literally everyone takes medication for something.
For something, yes, absolutely. Yes.
But then it was an innocent, naive thought until my friend walks to me and says, Brian, do you have HIV? I said, no, I don't know. What is, I do not have HIV. But then on my mind, I start thinking, by the way.
First, did you grow up with your parents?
No, I had lost both my parents.
Okay.
So I was under the care of my auntie, who later intimated to me that she equally didn't know how to tell me that. And like we did for the interview, that's why treatment literacy is very important, both for the caregivers and the people who are on treatment. So She didn't tell me out of love, because at the time, I think, there was not so much information about disclosure and how to go about it. So she didn't know how to tell me that.
To have that conversation with you.
Yes. First, she wasn't confident enough, but then also out of empathy, like any mother, she didn't know how to tell me. And I understand why. Because if she had at the time, I had so many questions that I don't think she had answers to.
Right.
So when my friend walks to me and asks me if I have HIV, I refuted him, like, no.
Why did your friend go to HIV right away? Was it something that was...
Very good question. Yeah. Very good question. So the long story cut short about that, my friend's auntie had been taking antiretroviral drugs. And so, with the stigma around the community, his parents had told him, you know what? Your auntie this and this has HIV. And so that medicine she takes every day is for HIV. So I think somehow, as young boys, he sneaked into my suitcase and compared the medicines and realized they were the same.
He made the connection.
Yes, he made the connection. While on my tests, I'd been going to the hospital every month. And it had never dawned to me that the medicine was for HIV.
What did you know about HIV at the time?
All I knew was HIV is got through having unprotected sex and having a blood transfusion. And at the time, I had not had any. And so there's no way I could have thought that I have HIV.
Did you know that? Because, I grew up in Uganda, and I remember when HIV first started, you know, when our awareness was raised about HIV. And at the time, it felt like when you had it or anybody had it, it was like a death sentence.
Yes, it was. And It's been a lot of effort to refute that. And like you said, I'm sure you're about to ask, did you know about mother-to-child transmission?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. Even right now, in 2024 era, people still do not believe that an HIV-positive mother
mm-hmm.
who is on treatment cannot pass on the virus to their child.
Mm-hmm.
They still, like, it takes a lot of sensitization, a lot of information sharing for them too. Like, right now with the work that I do, I work so much with the communities and the area psychosocial support clubs where I engage caregivers, and most of these caregivers are primarily not parents to these children. So it's a whole shift with them taking in that health information and them trying to now demystify what's already on their mind. So they ask questions like, so is your wife HIV positive? I'm like, no. How come she's not? I'm like, because there's a lot of innovations. There's a lot of science that stops that. Then they will ask, so do you think this child that I'm taking care of will grow to a certain age? Do you think they'll attend school and graduate like
will you? Will they have a normal life?
Yes, do you think they will have a normal life?
Those are the people that you work with.
Yes. And if you've not had the background like mine, you'll be very mad, like you'll be judgmental. But for me, I actually understand they're asking from innocence. They're asking from innocence because they do not have this information.
Mm.
So that was my case as well.
So what are some of the mental and emotional challenges of having HIV/AIDS in Uganda?
Stigma. Mm. Stigma is the biggest, and the stigma comes with, one, the HIV itself, but with the cultural attribution to mental health. I mean, mental health is attributed to witchcraft. Mental health is a Western man thing. I mean, you do not expect someone in rural southwestern Uganda to say that my psyche is low, going through mental...
I have depression.
Have depression. To the point that in your routine, a clinical assessment, even for those that do not live with HIV, mental health would be the last thing they will think of. Mm. So someone comes back from a clinic appointment and tell you they did all the tests and they didn't find any sickness. And then you, out of curiosity, because I do the work, I'm like, so did they do any mental health assessment? Like, those
are for white people.
Yes. Those are for white people. That's not a black man.
I've had
thing.
Somebody say that, yes.
Yes, and in the end, we've had people lose their lives. I've lost a couple of friends growing up, and this was through mental health breakdowns. I've contemplated suicide myself at some point, not once, not twice. And I was only helped because I'm exposed to this information. I know where to get support, which I don't think everyone else in my situation does.
Mm. What would you say creates that low point? Is that the way you interact with the community? Is it when you feel sick in your body? Is it just the expectations that, you know, I might not live long enough? Where's the breakdown?
So the breakdown is both external and internal. But I feel the external catalyzes it the most, because already you have doubts within yourself. And so as you're struggling with your own self-acceptance, coping with your situation, then you get a whole community that actually approves to what you're already thinking.
Yeah, and they basically co-sign on you already.
Yeah, sure. And that breaks you down automatically.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you were able to live a healthy life up to now. You're still, you know, you're still on, you know, taking your antiretroviral medication. How difficult is it to maintain the discipline of, you know, taking it daily?
Yeah.
What are some of the challenges that people face who have to be on this medication?
I think I've been lucky to be introduced to EGPAF's area psychosocial support clubs, because over time they've built in us this resilience, they've provided the information, they've exposed us to the opportunities to know that we can live meaningful lives. But this is not the case with everyone, because even me with all this exposure, there are times when I break down. I mean, I have had to explain to people that I've had my viral load suppressed for my viral load undetected for over 8 years, and this means the level of virus in my blood is undetectable.
Zero, basically, almost zero.
It can't be transmitted, and this is a whole lot of science that you need to explain to a layman, outside the HIV world. And so, for me, the biggest issues are. The biggest issues and trying to cope up acceptance. I've overcome that, but I even have friends that still struggle with that, like trying to explain. I'm a very social person, so someone would randomly walk to you and say, by the way, is it true that I'm sorry, there's something personal I want to ask you. Mm. I'm like, go on. Mm. I'm told you have HIV, is it true? I'm like, yes. Like, no, like...
Yeah,
you speak about you speak about it freely,
and this is a young person.
Exactly.
Obviously, you would think that the stigma exists, or in much older people.
Exactly. But actually, it exists much more in young people, because young people are still evolving. They are struggling with relationships, how to disclose their significant others and their partners about their status, but also how to let them know that. Yourself, even when I am dating you, I'm not able to pass on the virus with you. They're still struggling with school. I mean, we went to boarding school and we all know the bullying that comes with it. And I mean, that's the age where everyone is trying to figure out themselves. And then the community itself. Mm. So it is more with young people, actually, than with the old people. I mean, with the old people, they do not have to take the medication when everyone is seeing, because they can figure out their convenience. A young person has no option, because he's either in class or in the dormitory or under the care of a caregiver whose other siblings are not taking medication.
Mm. What are some of the ways that people can create a supportive environment for people that are living with HIV/AIDS?
When I feel it's all, and I still emphasize, it starts with information, like sensitizing, but then also peer support groups. And the peer support groups that EGPAF runs through, the area psychosocial support model, is all inclusive, because we have caregiver meetings, and the caregiver meetings are basically not just for people living with HIV.
It's everybody.
This is for everyone who's taking care of a child or someone who has HIV in their family. And that spreads out, I mean, to the rest of the community. We've seen behavior change for people who attend these caregiver meetings, where at first when they're introduced to them, you'd really see like there was a lot of disbelief in the information. But over time, these same people have become change agents, and they've stood up for their children that are in their care and said, no, I now know that my child can live a meaningful life. We've seen caregivers who had taken their children living with HIV out of school because they had been told they are wasting resources, their children want to live up their time, and they have now brought them back to school, and there are better outcomes from that.
Chatting with Ugandan activist Brian Ahimbisibwe. Brian is an ambassador with the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. As we mark World AIDS Day, Brian talks to us about the need for more work to be done to counter stigma, gender inequality, and other barriers to healthcare. Let's talk a little bit about the medication. How hard or easy is it to access medication for people, especially living in the rural areas, or even poor people living in urban areas? How do you access the medication yourself?
The medication access is, they've been programs that provide medication up to, I think, the health center too, and which is a good thing. From the cities to the rural centers, there's access to antiretroviral treatment. The gap, and what I advocate most for, is the mental health and psychosocial support services. Mm.
That is the part that is being left out. They think that if they give you the medication, you're good. If they look after your body, then you're fine.
Very good. Yeah. And I know you intentionally asked me about the medication. Mm. But from a personal perspective, I think medication for me is not just these pills that I have to swallow every day. For me, the medication is the all-round support that I need to swallow these pills. I mean, I can have, we've had situations in the area of psychosocial support clubs where this child has mastered the game and they know every time they come to the clinic, they count the number of pills they have, and so they mark them as 100% adherence. Mm. What are the back of their homes? They've dug a pit like in the banana plantation and they keep throwing all the medication. Mm. And so every time they try to monitor the amount of virus in their blood, it's shooting up. Mm. And they're wondering, they've done treatment failure and it shows that the treatment is failing. And yet it's not.
Because they're not taking the medication.
Because the child is not taking
the
medication.
Why do they do that? What is the reason?
Because their mental health is down, because they've not had enough reason for them to keep taking their medication, because they feel they've been left to themselves. Like myself, I mean, you imagine they have so many unanswered questions that are not attended to, and they do not find any reason to keep taking this medication. But on the outlook, they will tell you. And so it takes a whole lot of investment, of resources, of time to get these young people open up to you. Several of them have opened up to me and they're like, oh, by the way, I am sorry, but don't tell anyone. This is between us. Mm. Everyone thinks I'm taking my medication, but I'm not. I stopped a month ago. Like those treatment holidays. And so when you dig deeper, you realize maybe they face stigma at school or maybe something is not going on well at home, but they cannot tell it to anyone.
Mm. Yes. I know, and you know, let's talk a little bit about policy. I know one of the biggest programs here in the U.S., PEPFAR, there was a time, I think last year, the U.S. Congress was struggling to pass that as part of their budget. I was hearing a lot from activists on the continent saying that this is a matter of life and death for millions of people if PEPFAR is not funded again. Were you worried that if the U.S. or other major donor countries that are helping provide some of this healthcare pull back their funding, that it could be a problem for you guys because the local government probably doesn't have the resources to chip in?
I wish you could walk me down to the person that's in charge of reauthorizing PEPFAR because I would want to tell them my personal perspective. You know, Uganda was the second PEPFAR beneficiary country in the whole world. And coincidentally, I was the second on treatment at the hospital where I've been getting treatment to.
Wow.
And so when I read and heard about the PEPFAR reauthorization, that actually is still not concrete PEPFAR. Traditionally, PEPFAR was reauthorized for 5 years. Right now, they have a one-year authorization. I do not know how much I can emphasize to them that this is a matter of life and death. I know several peers, I know myself, wouldn't have lived to do this podcast and interview if it wasn't for PEPFAR. And that's why I reemphasize that I do not know how much I'll tell them how important PEPFAR is. And the discussions have been that it was an emergency plan then, but you realize that PEPFAR has evolved to not just HIV. PEPFAR has built health systems. They have strengthened the systems they have built. Mm-hmm. The program has integrated many other challenges in the system that we work for. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when COVID was here, it was the structures built through PEPFAR mandates that address that.
And women's reproductive health,
exactly.
Malaria.
Yes, and nutrition. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, and so indeed it is a matter of life and death. I don't think our governments would have the capacity to even run the program for a month if PEPFAR closed. And so for me, I add a voice to many that have said that it is as important as for PEPFAR to be reauthorized as it is to give life to someone. Mm. And I'm forever grateful to George Bush for PEPFAR. Yeah.
Absolutely. Brian Ahimbasibwe, thank you so much for taking time to come and chat with us here on The Voice of America.
Thank you. And maybe sometime you'll host me with the person in charge of authorizing PEPFAR.
Absolutely.
I'll be glad to emphasize to them how much impact it has.
Listen,
had.
I know there are hearings that are often taking place in Congress, and they have people like yourself who have been impacted, because policymakers can sit behind these walls and many times don't understand the connection between some of the decisions they make and the impact it's having on the ground. So it's always nice to put a face to the people like yourself who are great ambassadors of these type of projects. But thank you so much again for coming through.
Thank you, Jackson. As you close, imagine with the HIV history, being able to live a time when you know that HIV can't be passed on. It wasn't unimaginable.
Absolutely.
It wasn't thinkable. So for me, that's the most important, and I'm grateful that you gave me this chance to talk to you about this.
Thank you, thank you. That was Ugandan activist Brian Ahimbasibwe. He's also an ambassador with the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. He joined me in studio.
What's up, Africa? You are listening to Upfront on The Voice of America.
It's not just rejection, but also violence. Mm-hmm. There have been cases where when a woman has gone back home and told her husband that she's HIV positive, and he would beat her up, you know, sometimes even kill her, because he will say she's the one who brought the virus home. But in most cases, we know that those women, the disease is being brought to them rather than them bringing it to their home themselves. Mm-hmm. And so because of the stigma that exists in our communities about HIV, most people don't reveal their HIV status, because when they reveal their HIV status, they are discriminated against.
This is Upfront on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Analysts say that Western photojournalism has historically played a significant role in shaping global perceptions of Africa, often perpetuating stereotypes and misrepresentations. They say that even in contemporary times, many Western photojournalists, despite good intentions, unintentionally replicate these patterns, their focus often skewing towards themes of poverty, conflict, and disaster. Cameroon-based photographer and visual storyteller Emily Pina says that this one-sided framing often overshadows Africa's diversity and progress. She joins me to talk about her photo book titled Thriving Africa, Dynamic Creativity, which she says counters some of the negative representation of the African continent.
So in my life, I always had two passions. One was making a difference, having an impact, and photography, design, and so on. And I would either work in one field or the other. It was really just during my master's at MICA in 2014 in social design that I was able to marry these two. Mm-hmm. And I came up with what I call now visual storytelling. So I'm telling the stories visually of projects and the impact of people.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you choose your subjects or your topics or your projects? Are there any specific qualities that you look for that you feel will resonate with the viewers?
So often I'm approached by different UN agencies who have a very clear idea of the success stories they want to tell. Mm. However, what makes my work different than from other people, I really only focus on a positive narrative.
Okay.
I will never compromise the dignity of the people I take pictures of, and it's always like, even in the most desperate situations, I look for the perspective and the angle of resilience and hope.
Mm. So you work in Yaounde, but also across West Africa. What unique aspects do you look for
when you're trying to capture these you know, these places? And what have you learned about, you know, photography and visual storytelling?
Wow, that's a deep question here. I look for the glimpse of of hope and resilience in people. It's really, I'm focusing on people. That's really my main focus. And I also really focus on showing a different side of Africa, right?
You have a new book here, Thriving Africa, coffee table book. I was just looking through some amazing photos here. Tell us about this book.
Yeah, so the book, as you can see, is called Thriving Africa, Dynamic Creativity. Because 80% of the visuals coming from the continent are poverty, war, disasters. 20%, best case scenario, safari and folklore. But enabled, empowered Africa, creative Africa, innovative Africa is really underrepresented. And so with this book, I want to make a difference. And the idea is not only the book, but it is also having exhibitions and create roundtable discussions and so on around this topic, right?
When did you start? When did you work on this? This news this year?
So this book, I launched it a year ago, almost a year, self-published. It's a collection of pictures I took for the past 7 years, because I've been the official photographer for the CCMC fashion incubator for.
So you're based in Yaoundé.
I am based in
Yaoundé. What drew you into Yaoundé?
Well, one thing led to another, one assignment led to another one,
So you're now permanently based on the continent.
I am permanently based on the continent.
Yeah, I always say that the continent is such visually rich, and wherever you look, you can take an amazing photo.
Yeah.
You know. So how do you avoid caricaturing people or demeaning people, as you say, in your photography, so that people, when somebody's looking at it and they're interpreting it, they're not taking out the wrong message?
Yeah. So my work is really based on empathy. So what I do, and that's why I'm not a journalist or photographer, I'm a visual storyteller. So what I first do, I sit with the people. I don't even take my camera out. I sit and I listen. I ask questions, I listen to their stories, find some personal, you know, connection. It's really about creating a relationship of trust. Mm. And so people open up, they show me their houses and so on. I really believe that empathy is the most important thing. In my pictures, for me, photography is about evoking emotions, but it's the emotion of compassion and empathy, never pity, right? So it's really about preserving the dignity of the person. So,
to be able to gain people's trust, to allow you even in their space, you sit with them, you don't take out the camera.
Yeah.
Well, what happens if, why did you choose that way? Because what happens when you take out the camera first? What is the reaction they people have usually?
Oh, then they're like, no. Because, you know, there have been too many people, too many journalists coming, snapping pictures, taking something away from the people and run. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows what they're doing with the image. People have the right, first of all, to say yes or no to a picture. At the end of the day, they love seeing their pictures and seeing a positive story about themselves.
Right? What medium, what camera do you use? Do you have a specific camera that you use?
I have a Canon R5. Mm-hmm. Yeah, love it.
And, you know, do portrait work, fashion.
Yeah.
I see that you do some traditional, I see people wearing traditional clothing. Obviously, we'll show that. But what are some of the lessons you've learned in your time in West Africa in terms of how you frame a narrative visually?
For me, it's all really about being authentic. Mm. I mean, trying to reveal the authenticity
of
the people.
What role do you think photography plays in creating social change?
Yeah, it's one of the key tools, really. Because, again, in my phone photography masterclass, you know, we go through a lot of different things, and it's very hands-on, but a lot of it is like creating awareness of what you want to convey with your pictures. And it's really the people who need to change. It's not only me who's trying to change the narrative of the visuals coming from the continent, but it's, of course, it's really in our hand to guide the viewer's eye. And photography is a very, very important tool.
Cameroon-based photographer and visual storyteller, Emily Pienaar. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to our guests and to you, our listeners. Remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are at VOA Africa. Check out our website at voaafrica.com for more episodes of Upfront and other shows. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead, Africa.